Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Stack Waddy Game, I've got a belter, Mark. It's cool. Sent in by a listener, and this is really good. Sent in by Phil Kinderman. This is really good. I won't explain to you the premise. You'll get it as I go through them, okay?
Okay, yeah.
You've got to spot the odd one out of these. Chicago 36, Tubular Bells 4, Bat Out of Hell 3, Peter Gabriel 4, Toto 14. It sounds like a bizarre kind of Scottish League Division 2 rock band.
It does. You actually had that tone of Toto 14. Yeah. That's right.
Just once you have a number, that's what you naturally do.
Yeah.
I'll do it again. Chicago 36, Tubular Bells 4, Bat Out of Hell 3, Peter Gabriel 4, Toto 14. One of those doesn't exist. Which one? Sent in by Phil Kinderman. Excellent idea.
It's a really good idea. Well, there were at least four albums called Peter Gabriel and Toto, Bat Out of Hell. There were three Bat Out of Hells. What was the second one again?
Tubular Bells 4.
Yeah, there were four Tubular Bells. I'm tempted to say it's not Chicago 36 because that's so absurd. And there were so many records just called Chicago that I'm prepared to accept that there actually were 36 Chicago albums. I'm saying it's Toto 14. The world did not want 14 albums called Toto by Toto.
Well, it got 14 albums Toto. So Chicago 36 is real. Bat Out of Hell 3 is real. Peter Gabriel 4 is real. Toto 14 is real. Tubular Bells 4 is not real because there were only three.
No, you're right. That's really good. Phil Kinderman, that's very, very good work indeed.
Really.
Bless him. I just got sent one from a subscriber called Harry Lingard, which I thought I'd try out now. This is a departure from the normal thing, Dave. Different structure, okay? So the premise is black metal band or item of IKEA furniture. It's really good. It's really good, okay? And I've got 10 of them, and you've got to get... It's going to be 10. And if you get more than half of them right, you've won. It's simply, your question is it a black metal band or is it an item of IKEA furniture? I'm sure you're going to have to guess. Oh, okay, yeah. Number one, Sargeist. It's good, isn't it? Sargeist. So you're going to say, is that some flat plaque assembly shelving or is it a black metal band? Sargeist.
It's a black metal band.
You're absolutely right. Finnish black metal band formed in 1999. One to Hepworth. Clubbo.
How we spelled it that?
K-L-U-B-B-O. Clubbo.
Oh, good grief. Flat pack furniture.
Very good. Again, you're right. It's annoying. It's a coffee table. Grundtdal, G-R-U-N-T-D-A-L, Grundtdal. Is that a black metal band or is that something from IKEA?
Black metal band.
It's not, it's a wall shelf. Einherjar. Einherjar. Three more from them.
Black metal band.
Yes. Oh, no, you're soaring here. Well, they're a Viking metal band from Haugesund, Norway. That's brilliant. Okay, Sko Baby.
Spelled?
S-K-O-B-A-B-Y. Sko Baby.
Black metal band?
No, it's a three-seater leather effect sofa. I thought you might get that one because Sko Baby doesn't sound kind of hard and aggressive enough to be a black metal band. But okay, no, that's good. So you're over halfway, I think. Drugged. D-R-U-D-K-H, Drugged.
D-R-U-D-K, black metal band.
Yes, Ukrainian black metal band. Oh, my God, you're doing well. Okay, where have we got to? Kraft.
Item
Kraft.
flat pack furniture.
No, that's a ringer too. It's a Swedish black metal band originally formed under the name Nocta in 1994. Three, four. You've got four right. You've got to get two of the next two right to win. Okay. Akerkoke. So A-K-E-R-C-O-C-K-E. Akerkoke.
Oh, good grief. Flatback Furniture.
No, no. They're an extreme metal band from London formed in 1997. I know, it's absurd, isn't it? And the last two are Boholmen. Boholmen.
Black metal band.
It's a stainless steel sink. and Bastig. That's a great name. Bastig.
Flatback Furniture.
Yeah, it's a nickel-plated handle. You've got five out of ten. I'm going to let you say you won, because that's fantastic. That's a superb performance. But it's very funny, wasn't it?
Who sent that in?
That was sent by Harry Lingard. That was really good work, actually. Just
very good work.
Actually, he sent loads more than that. I just picked the best ten. It's very, very funny. So what's been happening? Well, Bill Bailey won Strictly Come Dancing yesterday.
Are you an avid viewer of...
No, I'm not an avid viewer at all. I've never watched it before, but I just love Bill Bailey. I'm sorry. I absolutely love him. I just got interested in just keeping tabs on whether or not you get booted out in the first episode. And believe it or not, and this is a moment of great national celebration and a testament of hope for all of us in these troubled times, that Bill Bailey actually won last night, and that was just fantastic. I made a terribly emotional speech. Oh, it was just brilliant television. And it reminded me that we should plug, I think, two great clips, which I might post at the end of this, actually, of Bill Bailey's two of his great musical clips. One is, have you ever seen the one he does an impression of a catastrophic technical failure at a U2 gig? And he's just making the point that Edge's guitar is entirely about sound effects. Yeah. And he can with one guitar make a sound exactly like U2. But the moment the effects turn off, it's just him going winky dinky dinky dinky. And it's just very, very funny bit of comedy. And the other thing, which I think is absolutely brilliant, which I discovered a while back, is he does this impression of Billy Bragg. He's busking somewhere and someone is being filmed. He does an impression of Billy Bragg, a song about a girl called Debbie, working in a politically oppressive chip shop in Raynham. And this girl gives him a look that he interprets as, help, I'm a woman in chains. And he has to assert his masculinity. And it is just one of the funniest impressions of anyone. It's so like Billy Bragg, his mannerisms, his vocal inflections, the types of songs he writes is really funny. We'll post that too. So look out for it. The other big event, I think, this week, which you've seen it too, I think, isn't it? I think it's a big event. It's the Bee Gees documentary.
I saw it. I watched it yesterday. Now, I have to say, it annoyed me in the way that loads of rock documentaries annoy me. You think, well, obviously they're going to have a member of Oasis in here. You know, talking heads
will appear.
You've got to have that. And nobody gets a complete sentence out in an interview at all. No, everything's just cut in two, you know. Sorry, I'm going to say something positive in a moment. And yeah. I don't know if you feel this when you're watching rock documentaries nowadays, because there are so many of them, that the old magazine editor in you can't keep them below the surface. Because after about 20 minutes, you want to go, stop, hold on, tell me that again. Let's just go into that little bit in a bit more detail.
A bit deeper.
That's really interesting but no, they don't do that. They just keep flying forward in search of their great arc of narrative. You know what I mean?
Which is always just pronounced highs and lows, isn't it? It's like, they were really, really successful. They sold millions of records, and then it was catastrophe.
Dun, dun, dun.
They couldn't leave the home because they were being sort of insulted by members of the general public.
Having said all that, the Bee Gees is an extraordinary story. It's an extraordinary saga, and they made some brilliant records over a long, long period of time. Probably longer than anybody else. You know, they've had more than one golden era, haven't they? You know.
Yeah, this documentary incidentally is called How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? It's by the documentary maker Frank Marshall. I found it on Amazon Prime, but it's all over the place. But yeah, two major, although my one beef is that they missed out a classic part of the Bee Gees story. I think I bet you know which one I'm talking about.
Unless I'm wrong,
the Bee Gees put out a record called, what's it called, Specs and Sparks?
Specs and Specs.
Spicks and Specks in Australia.
Yeah.
They then had written to Brian Epstein saying, you know, and sent him a cassette or something like that.
Yeah.
And got a letter back saying, if you come to England, Robert Stigwood, who works for my organization, will see you. They then, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying, got on a boat and they sailed. And in those days, it took 6 weeks, sailed to England to see Robert Stigwood. And when they got to the Suez Canal, which was about halfway through, they got a message saying they were number one in Australia. So they were completely conflicted. They now got a hugely successful career, the number one single in Australia, and we're going to a completely uncertain future in England. I thought that was a really, really interesting part of the
story.
It's not in there at all.
I'll tell you the other thing that I don't think was in there at all, unless I completely missed it, is I don't think You Win Again is in there at all.
No, it's not.
Which was an enormous bloody UK number one hit, wasn't it? And that was like another comeback from whenever that was. And I don't know how long ago that was. It's not in there at all. But they do the story they want to do.
No. And it's one of the things that struck me straight away was that it's the Dave Hepworth theory that you can measure the value of pop music by its musical worth and by the personality of the people making it. This is one of your old theories. I think it's a really good one. The Beatles being an incredibly good example of someone who had maximum of both. But it struck me that the Bee Gees had immense, immense musical worth. Here, you know, I've got a CD here with 19 of their number one singles, you know.
Yeah.
Immense musical worth. But in terms of personality, I looked at them, and I know the Bee Gees very, very well. I thought, I know Robin. But which one's Barry again and which one's Morris? I just can't quite remember. I can't quite remember who's who.
I don't think anybody, I may be going out on a limb here. I mean, because I admire the Bee Gees hugely and I've loved loads of their records. And it's all about the records. It's not about them. It's about the sound of the records. And I've never once looked at, you know, and I bought the first Bee Gees single in the UK. UK New York mining disaster 1971.
Really good record.
There was no New York mining disaster in 1971. And I bought the first album and I've followed them ever since. But I don't think you ever looked at them at any point and thought they look cool. I don't think you ever thought that for a second.
Not even Morris, who was fabulous looking.
Yeah. No matter how much they tried or didn't try, you never looked at them and thought, that's a club I'd like to join. I think I'm right in saying this. Nobody ever looked at the Bee Gees and thought, I'd like to go for a pint with those guys. They look fun. You thought,
that's a brilliant idea. Go out with Robin Gibb for a knockabout bit of banter, a bit of bants.
They were kind of lost in showbiz, weren't they, from an early age?
Completely. But it's in two stories. It's two sections, isn't it? It's the huge success post-Beatles. They sound a bit like the Beatles, the kind of psychedelic sound, you know. And it's so cliche that Barry at one point says, before I was 21, I had 6 Rolls Royces.
Yes.
Why would you want even one Rolls Royce, really? Yes. But 6 Rolls Royces. What's the point of this? This is so cretinous and cliched, you know. But anyway, they have all that, and they're really successful. Then they fall from grace, and then they have to reinvent themselves. And that is really interesting, I think, isn't it? They go out to 461 Ocean Boulevard, because Eric Clapton, who's also signed to RSO, says, go and use the studio.
Well, and I think it's really interesting. Eric Clapton, this is classically the way these documentaries are put together, that they do an outline, and they go, now, where can we get some big rock names in here? Noel Gallagher, Chris Martin there.
Yeah.
Guy at the Jonas Brothers there, Eric Clapton, because he was on the same label, similar management and so forth. And they always say that the Bee Gees went to Miami because Eric Clapton told them to go to Miami because he'd been there and he'd made Four Seasons by Ocean Boulevard. And so Eric Clapton is interviewed, clearly has no memory whatsoever of saying this. You know, at the end of the interview, he goes, well, if that's my place in history, that's fine.
He's
quite genial about it.
Yeah, but they go, no, it fits. Just fits. Say it was. Just agree with it. Yeah.
Which he does, you know. And, of course, you get all the... I tell you, the bit I liked was Albie Gallatin and Carl Richardson, the engineer, redoing... And this is something they don't do often enough in these kind of films. Technically, how they did the drum loop on
Saturday Night Fever.
Was it Night Fever?
It was Night Fever. So it's Night Fever's the song. That's right. Yeah.
Because the story goes that the drummer Dennis Bryan had to go back to Wales because there was a funeral, and so
his mother was ill. Yeah.
They looped a bit of his drums, which they did in the most Heath Robinson way fashionable. Possible, because that's the only way you could do it in those
days. They spliced it out, didn't they, with a razor blade.
But he also taped it back in. You got a really long piece of tape, and then you had it running on the normal spool over there, and then you had Carl Richardson standing at the other end of the studio, twirling around a pencil or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Because that's the only way you could get it to pass the heads at the right interval that you needed to play it back. I love seeing that kind of thing.
I do. I couldn't agree more. And I thought it was an amazing moment because Dennis Bryan then returns from his mother's funeral or whatever to find that, in a sense, they don't really need him anymore. They've invented the drum loop, and this works. It's absolutely reliable. It never lets you down. It never varies.
And all these things, which are now just a button push away, used to be just really hard to do. And it's not that long ago, really. Well, you know. If you're as old as we are, it's not that long ago. Their part in all this is immense, no doubt about it.
I thought another really good bit was the thing about the kind of militant disco wars, because I didn't know that, you know, this is about...
I think they overplayed that.
They slightly overplayed it, but I didn't know that there was a law in even up to the mid-70s in New York clubs where you couldn't dance with a person of the same sex in a place that had a liquor license.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
So They obviously adopted the Bee Gees, you know, songs, you know, Jive Talking and stuff as a kind of major soundtrack for this movement, you know. And then there was the event. Do you remember the event was called? Was it called Disco Demolition Derby?
It blew up in
Kaminsky Park in Illinois. Disco Demolition Night, where they invited everyone to come along between two matches, like the Chicago White Sox and Detroit Tigers. And for 98 cents, you could get in if you bought a disco record with you, and they would blow them all up at halftime in the middle of the pitch. You know? I thought, this is just absolutely... Well, because the records they brought along were things like Al Green and Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye. Well, it's not disco records. So it all became a bit, you know, racist and a bit homophobic, really. But I thought, I don't know, I thought it was a really interesting story. They're great records, and I learned quite a lot about it.
I very much liked the because they got the additional thing of being brothers, which I think Robin said, no, I think Barry says at one point, after we got famous, I ceased to know anything about my brothers' personal lives.
Yeah, I thought that was
because good. You know, they lived kind of in the back of a van or whatever, a tour bus, and when they were on the road. And then when that stopped, they all went to their individual kind of Tudor mansions in varying different countries or suburbs or whatever, and all got married and all just pursued lives that the other two knew nothing about at all.
And I thought that was really interesting.
And developed eccentricities. And he says, somebody says, now I think Morris says, when you're on your way up, all the energies in the group are pointed inwards to making the group successful. Everybody's thinking about that. As soon as you've got that, all the energy points outwards to what can I do for myself, which I thought was a really good way.
That was a good point too. And I thought it was interesting they talked about the way they composed. And it's very unusual. It's three people writing together. That's very unusual. Three people writing together. And I think Noel Gallagher makes the point that, you know, actually brothers singing is like an instrument in itself, you know.
It is,
You know, the Everly Brothers just sounds like one voice duplicated. It's extraordinary, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really good point, that somehow they'd managed to work out a way of collaborating, the three of them, on these songs where nobody felt that they were getting squeezed out and everybody felt they deserved their songwriting royalty. And that kind of closeness, that kind of intuition, was really quite effective. And actually, Barry is quite funny. There's a point where Barry's, I think in an interview, someone said, he said, Morris and I are twins. That's basically how we met. It's pretty funny.
So what did you make of the interview with, and because they talked to the three you know, the three musicians, Blue Weaver, Dennis Bryan, and what's the name of the guitar player? I can't remember. Who were also part of their success and hugely important in playing on those records. And what did you make of Blue Weaver's interview where he talks about the composing of How Deep Is Your Love, which was, of course, an enormous...
Well, that was a fantastic part, because he actually had, if I remember right, he has a cassette of them...
He has a cassette of them writing it, trying out chords. He's playing the piano.
Yeah.
And he clearly thinks he partly wrote it.
Well, I think the story there is that he wouldn't have that cassette still hanging around if he didn't use it in a legal battle. Don't you think that might have been used? I think it would have been used.
It's not for me to say. But at the end of the interview, he says, I still feel it's emotionally part of me. And they hold the shot.
Yes.
His eyes missed over.
His eyes kind of
really
fill up.
Hold it. Because they're obviously trying to make the point without
I actually went and looked at the song to see what the credit was, and the credit is the three members of the Bee Gees and Blue Weaver, brackets, uncredited.
Yes.
So that's what it says. So there must have been some, but I'm fairly sure, because I met Blue Weaver once when we were on Old Grey Whistle Test, and I went out with the Damned to Jutland, as you did. I don't know, you were probably going to the Isle of Man with Nazareth or something. But it was my turn to go to Jutland with the Isle of with the Dam. And Blue Weaver was part of their setup then. He was helping working on a record they were making. Maybe he was producing or playing keyboards or something. And I just talked to him a lot and got his story. And I got the impression that they were offered a royalty for recording those songs, Night Fever, etc., or points. And he just thought, on a whim, he'd had some
points. Points is a royalty.
Oh, right. What do I...
A session fee or points.
And I think he'd had something done quite well for him recently. So he thought he'd just risk it. He thought, well, why not? It's been fun. They're interesting songs. They're different. It might just catch fire. You know? And so he went for points. And anyway, all I know is that when we got back to the part of West London I live in, I noted that Blue Weaver lives in a massive pile. A really fabulous place. So they got all right out of it.
They all live near you, Mark. That's what they all look forward to. You know, one day there'll be a great payday and we're going to live near
the same
Mark
street as Mark Ellen. No, it's a very different setup.
It's like the story of the members of Joe Cocker's Grease Band who were hired in by Tim Rice to do a session for a load of songs that they were doing at Olympic in 1970, I think. And they said, what do you want session for your points? And they said, oh, session fee. They just went and drank it, you know. And that was Jesus Christ Superstar.
Can you imagine? Oh, you'd be kicking yourself the rest of your life.
Probably.
But they did all right out of it. And the other amazing thing is, of course, that him and the drummer were both in Amen Corner. What are the chances of that? You look at a picture of Amen Corner in 1968 or anything. Two of those guys are going to go on.
Which two will be
kind of key prime movers in the disco revolution. It's astonishing, isn't it?
Anyway, How Do You Mend a Broken Heart? It's out there on all the usual streaming services. And let's
HBO.
Face it, what else have you got to do?
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
I saw that this is a really insignificant anniversary, Mark. This is on the 20th of December, 1999, the readers of UK Guitar Magazine voted Noel Gallagher the most overrated guitarist of the millennium. Jimi Hendrix was voted guitarist of the millennium, and Nirvana's Nevermind was best album. And I just thought, I can remember all those times in my youth where people used to sit around drawing up lists of who was supposed to be the best guitarist.
They did exactly the same with me, but actually just to say, Noel Gallagher, in his defence, who was saying that he was rated in the first place? Noel Gallagher, I mean, his solo on Live Forever that he plays note for note exactly the same. He just must have worked out, you know, methodically and memorized. You know, he's just not a natural lead guitar player, you know. And I can't imagine anyone ever thought he was. But no, you're right. When I was about, I don't know, it must have been like 12 or 13, something like that, we would sit around talking about who was the best guitarist. And the big issue was, this is so embarrassing, the big issue was, Is it, you know, Jimmy Page or Eric Clapton or whatever, Jeff Beck? Or is it Elvin Lee? Because he's the fastest.
He's the fastest.
And the fastest. He's faster. He can play more notes per minute, which is like saying a book's particularly good because it was written really quickly. Or
typed really fast.
What did Truman Capote say about Jack Kerouac? It was, yeah, that's not writing, that's typing. Wasn't it? About on the road, you know. So, I mean, which is ridiculous. But actually, you know, there are very few guitarists that you ever looked at in technical terms. I used to look at Bert Jansch and John Renborn and folk guitarists like that and David Graham and think that's technically incredible. How did they do that? But in terms of electric guitarists, I mean, did you sit there and think?
Oh, I went through the period of being very persuaded by. But the thing about playing the guitar is it was a display as well as an auditory experience, wasn't it? It was something you looked at, and it was kind of impressive to look at. Whereas playing the piano is not really just something about the guitar. It's because it's mobile and because it's roughly about the size of a machine gun, isn't it?
I always
think that's a huge part of its appeal.
It's a prop.
It's a prop. And also I fell for that idea that the higher up the fretboard they played, the more intensely they were feeling it, which is nonsense. It's just a cliche.
And all they good. Yeah. Well, that's right. I
remember those days sitting there, you know, writing down lists, trying to work out who should be third and who should be fourth.
Exactly. It's like a melody maker poll. I know.
It's such a boy thing.
It's a
ridiculous idea.
And so it is about tone, though, don't you think? BB King, I can't remember a single solo we ever played, but it's about a tone and a series of phrases.
That note.
Ernie Isley, it's just a tone. And Keith Richards and Robbie Robertson. There's not one single guitar solo by either of them that you can sit there and say, I remember that, or I can, you know, note for note. It's just that it's all about texture, really.
It is. This is why, you know, if anybody asks me now, not that anybody does, who's the greatest guitar player of your lifetime, I would probably say somebody like Steve Cropper.
Oh, that's good.
You know, because you just think about how many records Steve Cropper has played on in all kinds of different styles. And he's pretty much astounding all the way through.
He is astounding.
It's not a soloist or anything like that. It's just what he contributed to the sound of things. Although my favorite, the one guitar player that if I could choose one guitar player to listen to for the last half hour before I die.
I'm going to guess. It's Richard Thompson.
It's Richard Thompson.
Yeah.
Because he broadcasts on my frequency, you know.
You're also not quite sure what he's going to play. He's not completely predictable. I tell you, I absolutely love it. Here we are, debunking the whole idea of two blokes sitting around thinking, who's the best guitarist? Now we're doing it. We're actually doing it. But I absolutely love, he's not an electric guitarist, but David Rollins, you know, who plays on the Killian Wells. The other half.
All right, yeah.
Oh, my God, he's fantastic. That effortless embroidery, just beautiful, soft little phrases. And kind of, you know, doesn't push himself forward. It's just part of the accompaniment. He's absolutely never plays anything that you've
Well, so talking about Robbie Robertson, as you were, I note that they're reissuing Stage Fright.
The
band's third album. Was it third album yesterday?
Yeah.
Next year on some anniversary, I suppose.
And they changed the order of something?
They've changed the order because of the track listing, because this is apparently the order that comes out in February is the order it was all supposed to be, because apparently while it was being kind of mixed and presumably sequenced by Glyn Johns and Todd Rundgren, the band were on that, do you remember that train journey they took across United States and Canada, who did they go with? Go with the Grateful Dead.
The Grateful Dead and like. Janis Joplin, was that the one? I think it was. Yeah,
they were on a train, and so they were kind of incommunicado for a couple of weeks, and therefore they had no part in the sequencing of it, and that was done by producers and engineers. But I still think. It's a rum idea to me to take, you know, a 50-year-old album and change the running order, because the people who are going to go and buy it are the people who've been listening to the old version for 50 years, aren't they? And they're going to be annoyed.
They're going to think that's sacrosanct. And they'd be right. Yes. Don't you think?
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, because I would have thought, if you want to kind of republish what should have been the running order, fine. That's what Spotify's for. That's what streaming services are for. You can take those tracks, you can put them in any order you like, and that's fine. You've got the experience. But don't put it on a vinyl record or whatever.
No, it's wrong.
That somebody's
there are little there are little internet things where you can find, for example, the Beatles Abbey Road medley, and you can find it in its original version with the bridge for Mean Mr. Mustard in there. And Her Majesty's in there as it was originally, and then it was clipped out and they stuck it at the end as a secret track. When you hear that, it just sounds so jarring and so utterly wrong. You know, you don't look at it as a curio, an interesting thing. You just feel absolutely horrified by its existence.
You've been messing with my memories. You know,
I know, completely.
That's
wrong.
What you feel about it. So since we spoke last time, John Le Carré.
John Le Carré, yes.
I love John Le Carré. God, John Le Carré, let's be fair, was 89? Good innings.
Yeah, very good innings.
Very good innings. Fantastic career, you know, really successful for a long, long period of time and provided me with so much pleasure. I one of the things I always love about John Le Carré, and I was watching an old interview with him, was all the language and the terms with which you would refer to the world of espionage that his characters, you know, lived in. And this was, you know, you and I both worked one time or another on Shaftesbury Avenue. So you go through Cambridge Circus, and the, you know, the headquarters of the intelligence services of those days referred to in John Le Carré books were always the circus. And yeah. It was always supposed to be just above a tailor's or something like that.
Yeah.
So every single time I ever go through Cambridge Circus, I just look around, see if I could see where he might have sighted it, you know. But he used to refer to all the different specialisms of the espionage services by these wonderful names like the scalp hunters.
Yeah, scalp hunters.
The lamplighters, you know, the inquisitors, the janitors.
Yeah.
The mothers who are the kind of middle-aged ladies in the typing pool.
Brilliant band names.
And absolutely, you can make any of them band names. And I was watching an interview with him, because he obviously had some background in intelligence, where he said, you know, where do these names come from? He said, I made them up. And I couldn't think of a comparable case of an author, you know, taking a fictional world and just inventing a load of really plausible terms.
Completely plausible.
Because one of the great attractions of John Le Carré is that it's particularly attractive to males, I think, is the idea of an inner world. You know, here's a load of professionals talking to each other in their special shorthand. And don't you wish you knew it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
An immensely attractive idea. And in his case, he just invented it, all of it. You know, pavement artists were the people who followed people on the street. You know,
that's right.
Pavement artists.
Yeah.
And they were just beautiful ideas, and he did them with such conviction all the way through his books that I always thought, oh, he just, there's obviously those are terms used in MI6.
They exist. Precisely.
But no, he'd sat there at a typewriter. And he'd written them down, you know, for the first time. And
what great names for bands, though, mate.
Absolutely.
Honey Trap. Reminds me of The Russia House, The Looking Glass War.
Listen
to them, wouldn't you? Call for the Dead, Secret Pilgrim. In Peel voice, Madame Ostrovkova, Molly Meakin, Otto Leipzig, Toby Esterhaus. You know,
Debbie Hesterhaus, yeah. The people who at MI6 who made documents, forged documents, were known as the shoemakers.
That's brilliant.
And I tell you, I've just been looking again last night. I was looking. There's a wonderful biography of John Le Carré, if anybody's interested, but written by a guy called Adam Sisman. And I don't know how much you know about John Le Carré, but his father was a legendary reprobate con man. You know, living, you know, ducking and diving either side of the law.
Yeah.
Who caused him great embarrassment throughout his life. And I was just looking at the passage about when Spyro came in for the Cold, which is his breakthrough book, 1964, same year as the Beatles go to America, you know. And it was a huge hit out of the box in the United States. Within 6 weeks of being published, it was number one in the New York Times bestseller list. Later in the year, it was taken up by the Book Club of the Month. It was a selection, and that meant you sold 1 million copies.
Incredible.
1 million copies in hardback.
Astonishing.
He goes his first trip to New York. He's called off the plane by the stewardess when they arrive, before everybody else gets off. Mr. Le Carre, yes, just follow me. Goes down the steps, and there at the bottom of the steps, on the tarmac at JFK, is a limousine into which he's ushered, and his publisher is in there. Straight into the city, straight to the Plaza Hotel, facing a load of journalists. He's the biggest story in literary America. And then later that night, he's taken to the Stork Club or the 21 or one of these very ritzy, you know, hangouts. And there at his table, he's conducted to, is his father smoking a big cigar and a huge great drink, having arrived in New York about 2 months ahead of him to take advantage of his imminent celebrity.
Some celebrity. Brilliant.
And, has been borrowing houses free for 2 months on the basis of
his high on the whole. What's his relationship with his father? I mean, not good then.
Oh, really?
He hadn't seen him for long. So we're virtually in Freddie Lennon territory.
It's right. If Freddie Lennon had a kind of the smarts of Arthur Daly, you know, that would have been John Le Carre's dad. But honestly, the biography by Adam Sisman, I can't recommend it too highly. It's a really, really good book.
That sounds fantastic.
Talking of publishing things, I see Julie Birchall's been fired by her publisher.
I was following that, and I thought that was... I don't know why I was so entertained by it. It's wrong to be entertained by it. But, you know, Julie Birchall, when you sign Julie Birchall, you want her to be over the top and go the extra mile. And she does. I mean, what she was actually doing was writing a book about cancel culture, wasn't
yeah.
she? And the great irony is, of course, she's now been cancelled for by her own publisher, for an extremely unwise tweet, which had a kind of, anti-Muslim kind of sentiment to it, didn't it? So complicated.
But why do you sign Julie Birchall if it's not to go too far? What's the point? If Julie Birchall turns up at your office and say, I've seen the error of my ways, and in future I'm going to moderate my language, you'd think, well, we don't want you. We want somebody else.
We want Julie Birchall. Yeah, exactly. I know.
Talking of Islam, I was reading this morning that some guy had been tweeting about he'd Islam, Muslim background, and he said, my family had never celebrated Christmas. So it was always a bit odd to me. But obviously this year, because we're forcibly separated, I've decided I'm going to pursue Christmas. And so he had a really good series of tweets, this guy, about suddenly discovering Christmas, you know. He's done a whole 2 weeks about how it feels to be on the inside of Christmas for the first time.
Having never understood it. Isn't that amazing?
Never really understood it. I thought it was quite a sweet idea. I thought it was a classic case of, you know, what we're all going to have to do, which is make the best of it.
Make the best of it. My God, it could be a little, it's going to be a bit quiet, isn't it? There's no doubt about that. And the turkey will last a while.
The turkey will be taking turkey sandwiches to the beach in summer, I think. You know?
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Oh, it's with any other business. We're joined by Alex Gold. Hello, Alex.
Hi there.
We were talking, I think, last week about whether artists could stop other artists recording their songs. And you'd had a little bit of experience of this, hadn't you, with clearing tunes?
Yeah, one of my CD double lives is is in licensing. So from what I understand, you're perfectly free to record and release a cover song, and when you register it, part of the so part of the metadata. The metadata is all the track info. So you're talking writer, publisher.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
You have to import into the system when you release it. That gets traced and funneled through. So all sales, a percentage of that goes through to the publisher, and it all gets sorted out automatically by the collecting societies, basically. But you're free to record your own version, but you're not free to release anybody else's version.
Now,
artist can't stop you recording.
Well,
that's what interests me, because Prince did, didn't he?
I think he tried to. Because he always said he resented it. It's interesting you should say this, because I've been reading a book all about this week.
Uh-huh.
This is Adventures of a Jazz Age Lawyer, and it's about a guy called Nathan Birkin. And he was the guy who invented the collection agencies and all that back in the pre-First World War in the United States. And he was the person who established the kind of copyright we have nowadays. And he was the guy who established ASCAP, which is the great American collection agency on behalf of all the artists. And his theory was that the future of the music business is a river of dimes. It's all about tiny sums of money that just keep flowing forevermore. And so you, entering your metadata, you are playing your little part in the maintenance of that massive river of dimes. And this is an absolutely fascinating book, because if ever people think, they tear their hair about what's happening in the music business nowadays, and the old model's busted and the new one hasn't come along, you realize when you look back, 100 years or whatever, it's been changing absolutely all the time. And he came along at a time when the biggest music reproduction machinery, the most important thing was the player piano. It was the piano.
Oh, you had the sheet of paper with the holes in it that went across the... That's right. It's a pianola, basically.
Yeah, it's a pianola. So a piano that played itself, effectively. And recording wasn't considered a big thing. Radio wasn't even heard of at all. And so... publishers would pay performers to play songs in front of the public, because then the public would want to hear them on the piano roll or would go and buy the sheet music. So it worked in a totally different way. You know what I mean? They paid to get this stuff performed. And what he changed was he said, no, in future, you're going to pay in order to perform things. You're going to have to pay the collection agencies. And it took years and years to build up, but he eventually did it. And it's absolutely extraordinary. And his view was that the big money was going to be made out of cinemas, because cinemas in those days, silent movies, the top cinemas had orchestras, and the orchestras played all the way through the film. And so if you could get from those places a dime out of for every tune, and there were millions of these places up and down the United States, you could build an enormous great revenue stream, which he did. And the whole thing, the music business machine has reinvented itself at 20, 30-year intervals throughout the last 100 years, and will no doubt continue doing it in the next 100 years.
I love all that. Do you remember when we interviewed Simon Napier-Bell?
Yeah.
Simon Napier-Bell... Magic, you'll probably remember this. It was a Word in Your Ear event. He'd written a book about the history of the music industry. And there was a bit where he talked about the first musicals. And this would have been in either this late 19th century or whatever. And they used to pay people to learn the songs in the musicals, to sit in the audience and join in with the songs. And then afterwards, as they were leaving, sing the songs to give the impression that they were so catchy, that they were such instant hits, that that there might be a market in selling the sheet music. And they were actually paid to do that. Brilliant idea.
He makes an interesting point in this, which I never realised. It wasn't until the advent of radio that songwriting started to get quite sophisticated. Because if you wanted a hit, big hit song in the 1910s or, First World War, whatever, you had to make it simple enough that anybody could play it.
Yeah.
The challenge was, could you sit down at
a
piano?
Could you play at home on your piano? Because every home's starting to have
piano. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And once in the 20s and 30s, that was less of a consideration. because you were trying to interest people in the records. And so, and the songwriting became more sophisticated. The performance became more sophisticated.
Yeah.
It changed the music. It's always the same. Technology changes the music. It's not the other way around. It's technology changes the music.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating story. Absolutely fascinating story.
Now songwriting's changed to a formula where the objective is to A, grab the listener as quickly as possible and maintain their attention for as long as possible. So if you listen to a lot of modern pop songs, you know, your Billie Eilish's and your Taylor Swift's, you'll hear lots of sections that probably could be choruses one after the other. You know, it's just hook after hook after hook after hook.
That's
it. And it's just different hooks bolted together. It's really clever. You know, you get the, you probably get the purists going, that's not proper songwriting, but actually it's become a science, and it's,
well, the classic, if you want to know about this, the terrific book by John Seabrook, isn't it, Mark?
Yes.
The Song Machine.
Fantastic.
God, it's a good book. And John Seabrook, New Yorker writer, who became fascinated by the music that his kids listened to in the back of the car. And it was kind of Britney Spears and the Backstreet Boys. And he just, and it was so alien to him, he became fascinated. And he wrote a whole book about where it comes from, that music. And
there was, yeah, because there were the old divided hit sections. There was the top liners, were they called? The people who wrote the melodies?
Track and hook. Track and hook is the method, you know. And going back to
track and trace.
It's funny when going back to the Bee Gees film, there is a point in there, I think it's with Night Fever, isn't it, where he says that was the first case. Albie Luton says, so we started with the rhythm track and we just built on top of it. Well, that's now how all records are made, isn't it? You know,
completely.
But it was revolutionary.
At the time, that was
In 1976 or whatever it is that they...
There's another brilliant moment in the Bee Gees where they talk about, I think Arif Mardin is producing them, and one of them, Barry, I think, just suddenly does this falsetto. Mm. And he says, hold that. Now, that's interesting. That's a new sound. It's a bit like the moment, the changing point in Neil Young's life when he invented that high-pitched way of singing, which he didn't originally do. He said that became the trademark. Yeah. I love those moments when the whole thing changes.
Just a bit similar with Oasis, actually. Like when Liam was singing Cigarettes and Alcohol at a gig and he went, "Shine" for the first time. And Alan McGee went, do that again. And that became, his trademark.
Absolutely.
That's a good program. Do that again. Be a good radio program, wouldn't it? Do that again. And there's little moments in loads of music where people go, no, do that again. That mistake. Do it again. It's really interesting.
Make a career out of it.
What else is happening, Alex? Have we got any new Patreons or anything to talk about?
New Patreons, indeed. Absolutely. Welcome to you all. There is Hugo.
All right.
Mysterious Hugo.
Okay.
Mr. R. Dwensing.
A very formal.
Equally mysterious. A John le Carré character.
Yeah, absolutely. the more conventionally named Mike Smith.
I think we remember that, can't we?
Along with Richard Goodwin, and they are all annual patrons. Of course, you get 15% discount if you subscribe annually. And we also have a special
birthday celebration.
Indeed. Steve Edwards, Mitchell Edmund, and Jonathan Jacobson. So welcome to
them all. And they're
much appreciated.
They'll all be beneficiaries of the special Patreon-only Word in Your Ear annual, which we are doing later this week. Is that right, Alex?
Absolutely. There is nothing righter, in fact.
So we intend to be, you know, like the Windmill Theatre during the Second World War. We never close. So, you know...
Even on Christmas Day, we'll be there. Glass of green ginger wine. Paper hat at jaunty tilt.
Well, you know.
Talking about the original lineup of Wishbone Ash.
Yes, because as our motto has it, you know, let's face it, there's nothing else to do.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.